Lori McGaffin.
I'm Alan McGaffin.
And we're here to bring you the Sioux City Journal on this Sunday. This is October the 17th, 2021. Alan, would you like to start with the weather, please?
I'll open with the weather. As you're able to witness this afternoon, we've got a sunny, sunny sky, and that's the trend for the next several days. We've got a high of 74 expected under sun this afternoon, and tomorrow we got a few clouds coming in with a high of 74 degrees extended into tomorrow, and Tuesday 73 degrees and sunny skies with some winds of 8 to 16 miles per hour. Wednesday and Thursday are markedly cooler with highs only in the 57 degree range on Wednesday and Thursday.
I don't see any rain in the forecast, do you, Alan?
Nope, looks like a pretty dry week.
Yes. So we'll return to the front page.
Front page story here on enrollments at the area colleges. And generally, the enrollments are higher in most of the cities and the colleges, universities mentioned. We'll start with a story by Caitlin Yamada here called Climbing Enrollments. Most Siouxland colleges experienced enrollment growth this fall, with some hitting record numbers. Many schools report record increases in the number of international students attending. The 10th day enrollment reports gathered by most colleges and universities were anticipated this year, as last fall's post-secondary enrollments declined by 2.5% during the pandemic. While the COVID-19 pandemic impacted abilities by students to make campus visits, many universities made changes, such as virtual tours and paring the visits down to just one-on-one visits. Here's a look at how the schools in the journal's circulation area have fared. Morningside, for the third consecutive year, has enrolled a top five largest freshman class in history of the university, including the largest ever group of international first-year students. The class is comprised of 370 students from 19 states and 7 countries, including 32 international students. That follows two previous years of top five classes, with 368 freshmen that arrived in 2019, 358 freshmen arrived in the year 2020. Overall enrollment totals 2,411, an increase from about 100 students over last year. The key factor in large class sizes has been the campus visits, according to college officials. Though the COVID-19 resulted in a brief pause and a lot of modifications to campus visits for high school age students, Morningside was able to pivot to accommodate more individual visits instead of group visits. And the university engagement team worked to launch a new virtual tour and implemented new social media strategies, which have apparently allowed prospective students to connect more directly with current Morningside students. To visit Morningside's to love Morningside. We've worked very hard to let our students tell the Morningside story in a variety of ways using social media and other communication channels. And we're really focused on encouraging visits so students can experience what life at the college is like for themselves, Vice President for University Engagement Aaron Edlund reports. Now over to Briarcliff. Briarcliff is reporting good retention of students with an increase in non-athlete first-time students this year. Total enrollment for this year is 1,001, with a freshman class of 169. The university saw 36% increase in non-athlete students and nearly a 3% increase in student-athlete enrollment compared to previous year. Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs Todd Kneeling reports, "We're incredibly grateful and in awe of our retention this year. This has been a huge effort of many teams across campus. With the past 2 years of pandemic being filled with so much uncertainty for families, it's inspiring to continue to see academics be prioritized to support their future." Up in Buena Vista, for the third consecutive year, BV has experienced enrollment growth. Fall of 2021 enrollment totals 1,959 students, up from about 100 fewer a year ago, an increase of 5% over the past year and an 8% increase since 2018, according to the press release. Enrollment on Storm Lake campus grew from 733 in 2020 to 777 this fall, a 6% increase. BVU President Brian Lensmer says, showing gains in enrollment for the third year is testament of our new programs and wonderful work our faculty and staff continue to do in reaching, connecting, and retaining students, rewarding them with rich academic and co-curricular experiences that see graduates moving on to success beyond BVU. So moving outside of the immediate area here, we see Northwestern College, Dort University, USD, Northeast Community College in Wayne and Northeast Nebraska, and Wayne State College, as well as Western Iowa Tech Community College. Western Iowa Tech has 5,451 students enrolled this year, an increase of about 2% over last year. But all colleges are reporting some sizable increases in enrollment this year. Now we'll go back to front page and inside stories, and I'll turn it over to Terry.
Okay. All right, back to page one again. There is a story by Dolly Butts about the city council candidates. And I trust that our listeners have been aware, have been able to hear all four candidates for the three city council open seats have been covered by the Sioux City Journal this past week, concluding with Alex Waters yesterday. Ike Rayford, Matthew O'Kane, and Dan Moore were all featured individually this past week, and they had an opportunity to press their case for why you should vote for them. Well, the story here by Dolly Butts tells us that voters pressed four Sioux City Council candidates on several issues Thursday night, including those issues including fireworks, drug addiction, and mental health, and the ability of citizens to peacefully protest during a forum hosted by the League of Women Voters. First-time candidates Ike Rayford and Matthew O'Kane are facing off against incumbents Dan Moore and Alex Waters in the November 2nd general election. The top three vote-getters will win four-year terms that start in January. A couple dozen people attended the two-hour forum, which was held at City Hall and moderated by League member David Halas. During the first portion of the forum, panelists asked each candidate a different question, which the candidates had 1 minute to respond to. The second portion consisted of questions from members of the audience, which were read by the moderator. Early on in the forum, O'Kane was asked by a member of the panel how he would reach out to the roughly 20% of Sioux City residents who speak a language other than English at home. O'Kane, a 34-year-old K-12 art teacher, said the city needs to have employees who speak those languages and that the city's webpage needs to be available in every language that would be out there. Later on, a voter followed up with a question, with a variety of languages in our community, how would you intend to pay for this and comply with equal employment opportunity laws? And O'Kane responds, there are free services out there, including Google Translate, that although may not provide the most accurate translation services, it is a free service. We could open up the volunteer pool of people that maybe would be better equipped to help with translation services for certain events. The panel asked Waters, a 35-year-old who works as Director of Talent and Community Engagement at Morningside University, what his position on fireworks is, but a citizen posed that question to Moore, a 68-year-old Sioux City attorney who currently serves as Mayor Pro Tem. Waters, who's seeking his second full term after being appointed by the council in February of 2017 to fill the remaining 10 months of former Councilman Keith Radig's term, said he wishes people would be able to follow the city's current fireworks ordinance, which he said he thinks strikes a balance. The ordinance allows fireworks to be discharged only from 1 to 11 p.m. on July 3rd and 4th, and from 1 p.m. on December 31st until 12:30 a.m. on January 1st. There's been a recent call by different groups to ban fireworks altogether. I think that's something we need to look into, Waters said. I've heard about a lot of veterans and their response to the PTSD. I've not heard a calling out from groups such as Support Siouxland Soldiers. Waters said, I have not heard a calling out from groups such as Support Siouxland Soldiers or a larger group of veterans to ask for that. Moore, who is seeking his third term on the council, said he's not ready to ban fireworks and thinks allowing 2 days for the legal discharge of fireworks within city limits is a good compromise. I think we've made great strides with the public service announcements that we did this past year, giving citizens the 2 days to discharge fireworks, Moore said. I'm working with some citizens now on how we can improve some of the rules, maybe raise the fines. The city council has to make that decision. Another voter asked Ike Rayford why he should be trusted with this leadership position. Rayford, a 49-year-old corporate audio and visual technician who owns a corporate training and facilitation business and serves as Sioux City NAACP chapter president, responded that he's a man of his word. He said, I stand on integrity, I stand on faith, I stand on character. He noted that he serves as a deacon at his church. I have people call me every week because they're having issues and problems. I try to get out there and do what I can for them in the best of my ability. Waters addressed a question about the ability of citizens to peacefully march and protest in Sioux City without having any fear by saying he's proud of the city's police department and that protesters should have the right to demonstrate. They've done a great job of working with protesters, working with those organizations that are running the march or various causes, he said of law enforcement. A lot of times I saw our police officers marching and supporting them as well, passing out bottles of water, talking with them about their issues. A voter asked if all of the candidates to list the current drug addiction and mental health services that they support and which programs they would advocate that the city add. O'Kane said the city is just a piece of the puzzle, and how it works with the county and the state on the issue is the most important part. We need to encourage more mental health professionals to move to Sioux City so we have adequate coverage, O'Kane said. A couple years ago, Rayford said he believes Woodbury County created a position for a liaison who reaches out to people with mental health issues who were arrested. If there's money out there, Rayford said, let's make it happen. Maybe that's something that we can look at. I know that we're looking at dollars and looking at them tightly. We really do have to sit down and study what we can do, he said. It is so easy for us to sit up here outside of Dan and outside of Alex to say what we will do. As I said earlier, I will not make promises that I cannot keep. Waters said that the city's police force and first responders need to be supported as they deal with individuals struggling with addiction and mental health issues. We need to give them the resources so that they're not dealing with recidivism, the same people that they're dealing with over and over, and that they're trying to get clean or get off the streets, he said. We need to make sure that we're supporting those staff. Moore said mental health funding has been neglected over the decades and that now we're paying the price. Drug addiction and alcoholism is a disease, and it's one that needs to be dealt with at a different level than someone robbing a bank, in my opinion, Moore said. We're looking at programs like Hope Street that has been a very, very successful program for those who have addictions. Hope Street is a 10-bed sober living house for men at 406 12th Street, which opened in June 2019 in effort to combat the vicious cycle of homelessness and addiction plaguing the community. Hope Street relies on private donations rather than insurance dollars.
Next, a piece by Cole Bauer writing in the Norfolk Daily News. Byline Norfolk, Nebraska, the Elkhorn Valley Museum is putting a new twist on an old event. Because this year, the museum will celebrate Johnny Carson's birthday with a night of comedy and magic. Museum Director Ashley Brown reports, this year we decided to switch up Johnny Carson's birthday celebration that we usually host every year. Usually we just show the Johnny Goes Home special and we serve birthday cake, she told the Daily News in Norfolk. We have some regular visitors for that, but we really wanted to liven it up and give it a new face. The family-friendly acts will be performed by local people who register, Brown says. We're bringing in local Nebraska magicians and comedians of all ages. They don't have to have any prior performance experience. It just has to be people who are interested in putting on a 5 to 8 minute set for the community. She said the museum's hosted an event for Carson's birthday, but at least the past 10 years now. But this year's event pays tribute to Carson in a more personal way. I think it pays sort of a perfect homage to Johnny, especially to his early career and his boyhood. His first paid gig was to the Norfolk Rotary Club when he was 12 years old, when he performed a magic show. We just feel that it's a very fitting way to memorialize Mr. Carson himself. Someone reached out to Brown and others at the museum asking if there were any venues for the comedians in Norfolk at the same time they were brainstorming new ways to celebrate Carson's birthday, Brown says. So the timing was just great. It was a good way to bring in local talent that was seeking places to perform outside of Omaha and Lincoln. Museum doors will open at 5 p.m. October 23rd, that's a Saturday. Attendees can use the time to view the Carson exhibit, and the show starts at 6 and it runs to 9 p.m. There's a cover charge for anybody over 3 years old. Snacks and beverages will be available. Registration for comedians and magicians is still open. Anyone interested can register online or in person at the Norfolk Festival.
Oh, I think Johnny Carson would really like that.
He would appreciate that, yes. A story from the Associated Press. This week will begin a trial down in Georgia regarding the death of Mr. Arbery. He was run down by a father and son pair in Brunswick, Georgia last year, and he was shot. They justified their actions. The killers justified their actions by saying they suspected that Mr. Arbery was not jogging, but that in fact had committed some crime when they witnessed him running, jogging. But the story explains a framed photo on the wall of Travis Riddle's soul food restaurant shows the local sheriff arresting a gray-bearded white man with handcuffs behind his back, a reminder of all who enter that for Mr. Riddle, justice still waits to be served in the slaying of Ahmed Arbery. It shows Greg McMichael on the day last year that he and his son Travis McMichael were jailed on murder charges for killing the 25-year-old black man, Mr. Arbery. The McMichaels are charged with chasing Arbery in a pickup, fatally shooting him after spotting him running in their neighborhood. More than 2 months passed before their arrests after video of the shooting was leaked online, sparking a national outcry. The jury selection in the murder trial of McMichaels and William Roddy Bryan, a neighbor who joined the pursuit and took the video, is scheduled to begin tomorrow. For many, it's not just the three white defendants on trial, but rather it's a justice system that's allowed them to remain free for weeks after they pursued and killed Arbery. You got a corruption, then the good old boy system, then the racism. That's how I see it, says Mr. Riddle, who hopes to break away from his restaurant, which is called Country Boy Cooking, and attend some of the trial. Local activists plan a weekend rally at the Glynn County Courthouse in Brunswick, which is a working-class port city 70 miles south of Savannah, Georgia. And a car caravan's planned through the neighborhood where Arbery was slain. It's shaken the faith of the black and the brown communities in their ability to trust the justice system, says Reverend John Perry, president of the Brunswick NAACP chapter. Arbery's death last February of 2020 became part of the broader reckoning on racial injustice in the criminal legal system after a whole string of fatal encounters between black people and the police. There was George Floyd, there was the Breonna Taylor, there was Rayshard Brooks, among others. Akeem Baker, a close friend of Arbery's, still takes runs on the 23rd day of each month for a distance of exactly 2.23 miles to keep his friend's memory alive. Baker said he's frequently tagged in social media posts by people doing similar memorial runs as far away as the United Kingdom. I have to believe that this is going to be needed to bring change to Brunswick and to bring change to the nation in terms of racial justice, Baker says. The McMichaels and Brian are charged with 9 counts each, including malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, and other crimes. The men told police they used pickup trucks to keep Arbery from fleeing through the Shores neighborhood. Security cameras in an open-framed house under construction had previously recorded him on the site, and they suspected he was stealing. Greg McMichael, a retired investigator for the area district attorney, says he can be seen playing up his law enforcement ties on recordings taken by police body camera of officers dispatched to the scene after the shooting. Prosecutors contend Arbery was just jogging on a street 2 miles from his home. They say he was unarmed, and the police found no evidence he'd stolen anything. What remains to be seen is how much prosecutors emphasize evidence of racism in Arbery's killing. At a court hearing last year, a Georgia Bureau of Investigator agent testified that Brian told investigators he witnessed Travis McMichael stand over Arbery and utter a racist slur. Effing N dot dot, using the N-word, while Arbery bled in the street from 3 shotgun blasts. Travis McMichael's attorneys deny that. Investigators find text messages on Travis McMichael's cell phone from a year before the shooting in which he used the N-word twice in a single exchange. Prosecutors include the text and evidence filed in the public court record, but they haven't requested to use them during the trial. That trial begins tomorrow.
All right, we'll turn now to the opinion page. That's the 10th page of the front section of the Sioux City Journal today. And let's take a look, first of all, at the journal's editorial board, their opinion, their endorsement. As we were discussing the candidates for city council earlier, the journal endorses Dan Moore, Ike Rayford, and Alex Waters. And they write about the reasons that they would endorse those three. I will move on to the letters to the editor. This first letter comes from family members of the Woodbury Township Cemetery, Rexanne Smith, Sergeant Bluff. And so our listeners may be aware of this controversy regarding the cemetery in Sergeant Bluff. So Rexanne Smith writes, "There is a proposal to move the Woodbury Township Cemetery in Sergeant Bluff. There are many family members who have ancestors in the cemetery and concerned community members who are opposed to this project. A recent online petition has over 1,200 signatures in opposition to the project. A local historian has asked the cemetery board to leave the cemetery as it is, due to its significant historical importance. It's the oldest cemetery in Woodbury County. Any taxpayer who lives in Woodbury County, Woodbury Township, pays tax dollars for expenses and maintenance of this cemetery. For some of you, this is your money. Some people have said that this is just an emotional issue, or it's done all the time, or it's best for the community. The very worst part, it's being done purely for corporate profit. One should wonder if they will be destroying moving the nearby Floyd Monument to build Riverview condos or apartments next. The following questions are important to be addressed in this matter. 1. If most, if nearly not all, descendants are against this proposal, why is it even being considered? 2. If this is an issue of maintenance, as some are claiming it to be, why have no bids been procured to outsource this to a landscaping company? There are tax funds in the budget for maintenance. 3. When a landscape company was asked to make a bid after the board asked for voluntary help to mow, why did the board clerk basically run the landscape company off when they arrived to give a bid? And 4. Can we identify another instance of Civil War veterans' graves being dug up so an Australian-owned mining company can mine for more brick? Number 5, how has this Australian company been allowed to mine so close to this historic site in the first place? And number 6, why hasn't the board taken steps to get this historic cemetery designated and registered as an historic site with the state of Iowa? Other cemeteries not as old as this one have achieved that designation. So that's a lengthy and detailed letter from family members of the Woodbury Township Cemetery. Our second letter comes from Greg Popkes of Rock Rapids, Iowa, and he writes, ethanol important to economic well-being. He writes, driving through rural communities in recent weeks, it's been hard to miss the sight of farmers out in their fields harvesting their crops. This process not only helps feed the world, but increasingly it's helping fuel the world. Today, the ethanol industry purchases more than half of all the corn produced in the state, meaning the economic well-being of farmers and ethanol producers are very much tied together. Ethanol supports 350,000 jobs nationally, including tens of thousands in Iowa. Ensuring the long-term viability of this industry is critical not only to maintain these jobs, but to the thousands of corn growers across Iowa who count on this marketplace. As a result, it is important to take the steps necessary to ensure ethanol remains strong in the years to come, so that our ag economy remains strong as well. Carbon capture and storage, such as the Project Summit Carbon Solutions has proposed, can help achieve this goal. This substantial private sector investment will help ethanol plants continue to reduce the carbon intensity of their product, which will open new marketplaces that have adopted low-carbon fuel standards. These markets purchase low-carbon fuel sources at a premium, meaning there are huge economic benefits available to ethanol producers who have joined this project and the corn growers who sell their crops to these local plants. But it assumes that this project is approved and moves forward. For the long-term growth of our ag economy, I hope that it does.
A couple stories out of the business page this morning. From last week's news, just a re-emphasis on the president's attention on the bottleneck and the short supplies that seems to be leading to some inflationary price increases across the economy. And so the president acted on Wednesday. Biden wants to save Christmas, and that he just might be able to do. He announced Wednesday that the Port of Los Angeles now would operate around the clock, trying to alleviate the logistical bottlenecks that have left dozens of container ships idling off the California coast, waiting longer to get their products unloaded. Longshoremen will now work through the night. Major retailers and shippers have pledged to clear the cargo off the docks faster than before, changes that are intended to speed the flow of toys and electronics and other gifts to the American doorsteps during this holiday season. Today's announcement's a potential to be a game changer, Biden said as he acknowledged that people are starting to worry about everything from toasters to sneakers to bicycles to bedroom furniture, everybody waiting for something that they've purchased from overseas. However, the plan addresses only one link in the global supply chain outside of Biden's control, meaning Biden faces potential blowback from unhappy shoppers while also lacking the power to fix the mess. He can't force overseas factories to keep churning more products. He can't hire more truck drivers to pick the cargo up when it arrives. And he can't stop the pandemic that continues to disrupt operations worldwide. The bottom line is, Americans want the stuff, and there's very little that Biden can do to get it to them. A global economist at the Economist Intelligence Unit based in London describes the White House actions as pretty limited. I think the administration's doing what it can, but the reality is there's not that much it can do beyond what they're announcing, he said. Another executive director for the Randall Kendrick Global Supply Chain Institute at the University of Southern California, commends the president's efforts to bring various groups together and said more private sector companies would need to heed his call to step up operations if they want to address the problem. So we'll see how the president's urging of longshoremen and big retailers plays out in the next several weeks and see if some of those ships get unloaded or they continue to just idle out there and float waiting to get unloaded. Another story, and this one from Orange City, announces that Diamond Vogel last week broke ground on a new 36,000 square foot state-of-the-art laboratory and office space for its Diamond Vogel Paint campus. The construction of the Innovation Center is the latest phase of the company's building initiative, which started back in 2018 with several improvements to the campus at the south end of the Sioux County seat. Construction's underway with the Innovation Center project, with completion anticipated by the end of 2022. When it's finished, the expanded space will allow up to 60 research and development scientists to collaborate on improvements and advancements to Diamond Vogel's extensive line of paints and coatings. My family has been blessed with a great and long history of partnership in Orange City. We love being a part of the city and the state of Iowa, and we're excited to continue to invest in the community and provide opportunities for growth and success, said the chairman of the board, Drew Vogel, at the groundbreaking ceremony on Wednesday. President and CEO Jeff Powell said this new construction fulfills the need for additional effective and efficient space to continue exploring advancements in paint and coating technology for the customers. So congratulations, Diamond Vogel, and best of luck in the construction. A photograph indicates a very, very handsome building. We'll be sitting in about a year and a quarter's time up in Orange City. With about 33 minutes having elapsed since we started the broadcast, we'll turn to the obituaries for today.
All right, I'll start with Barbara Ann Dillman, D-I-L-L-M-A-N. She was from Camdenton, Missouri, formerly of Sioux City. Barbara Ann Dillman, 94, passed away Sunday, October 3rd at Lake Park Senior Living Center. The service will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. on Friday, October 22nd at Hedges Scott Funeral Home in Camdenton. And let's see if I have other news here. I will move on to Marjorie Janine Sanderson. She was 57 and she passed away Wednesday, October 6th at her home. A short prayer service will be at 11 a.m. on Saturday at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City at 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation and lunch will follow the service at the funeral home. And I'll then move on to the next one is Walter Keith Karstens of Holstein, Iowa. He was 85 and he passed away on Tuesday, August 24th. At the Good Samaritan Home, the Good Samaritan Society of Holstein. Service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday at the United Methodist Church of Holstein with Reverend Dorisa K. Colligan officiating. Burial will be at the Holstein Cemetery of Holstein. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday with a Masonic service at 7:30 p.m. by the Alpine Lodge 471 of Holstein. At the Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home in Holstein, the family requests that masks be worn at the visitation and funeral. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein is in charge of all arrangements.
From Blair, Nebraska, Bella Vista, Arkansas, and Far Texas, Mr. Kermit D. Andrews passed away peacefully in Omaha, Friday, September 23rd. Celebration of life for Kermit and his wife, Rayoma, will be 2 p.m. Sunday, November 14th, Lutheran Church of the Master, address West Campus, 1200 North 181st Street Court in Elkhorn, Nebraska. Arrangements with Westlawn Hillcrest Funeral Home of Omaha. Memorials may be given to the Nebraska Humane Society in Omaha in Kermit Andrews' name. Next from Sioux City, Mary, middle initial B, last name Bulit, spelled B-U-L-I-T. Mary Bulit, 57, died Wednesday, October 13th, services pending with Waterbury Funeral Services of Sioux City. In lieu of flowers, donations may be, Next from Lamars, Iowa, Ruth Borchers, 108. Miss Borchers passed away Friday, October 15th. Service is scheduled for October 22nd, 10:30, Lamars Bible Church in Lamars. Burial follows in St. John's Lutheran Cemetery, Preston Township, Akron, Iowa. Visitation scheduled for October 22nd, also 9:30 a.m. until service at the church. Arrangements with Rexwinkle Funeral Home of Lamars.
All right, next we have Larry Stratmeyer, formerly of Sioux City. He was 82 and he died Monday, October 4th, surrounded by family. A military funeral will be held in Montana next spring at the Yellowstone National Cemetery. And then I'll move on to Kenneth Anton Mueller, formerly of Ricketts, Iowa. He died on Sunday, October 10th, 2021, as a result of an auto accident at the age of 25 years. Visitation with family present will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday at the Huebner Funeral Chapel in Charter Oak, with a time of sharing at 6:30 p.m. Fouts Funeral Home in Dunlap is in charge of arrangements. And then the next is John Joseph Hughes of Sioux City. His last name is spelled H-U-S-E. He was 94, and he died on Friday, September 24th at a local care facility. John's body was cremated and will join his wife, Rosemary, at the National Cemetery in Arlington, Virginia, where her ashes were interred. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday at St. Teresa of Calcutta Catholic Parish in Dakota Dunes, with a visitation 1 hour prior to service time. The service will be live streamed, and arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Online condolences can be expressed through the Meyer Brothers website. It was John's wish to have no flowers, but that any donations be made payable to Blessed Teresa Church Building Fund. Norma Stansberry of Sioux City was 68 years old, and she died on Friday, October 15th. Services will be at a later date, and the burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery, arrangements with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Kathy Hartman, she was 75, of Sioux City, and she died on Thursday, October 14th. Services at a later date and arrangements with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. And Terry L. Jeffords of North Sioux City, he was 69. He died Thursday, October 14th. No services per his wishes, and arrangements are with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City.
Continuing obituaries here from formerly from Sioux City, Lois J. Casey, 92, formerly of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, October 7th at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. Cremation has been accorded under the care of the Mitchell Family Funeral Home of Marshalltown. A celebration of life will be held Saturday at First United Methodist Church in Sioux City. Visitation with family, 10:30 a.m. with services at 11 a.m. To leave condolences, please visit the Mitchell Funeral Home website. And that was in Marshalltown for the Mitchell Funeral Home. Next from Lake Forest, Illinois, formerly Sioux City, Jeffrey Roland Chiquin, Mr. Chiquin was 75, passed away Friday, October 5th, after enduring a long illness. With courage and grace, visitation will be held 5 to 8 p.m. with short prayer starting at 7:15 on Friday at Wenban Funeral Home. That's W-E-N-B-A-N, the Wenban Funeral Homes of Lake Forest, Illinois. Funeral Mass at 10 a.m. on Saturday at Church of St. Mary, address 175 East Illinois Road in Lake Forest. Arrangements are with the Wenban Funeral Home. You may visit their website for more details. Contributions in Jeff's memory may be made to the Roland Chiquin Family Scholarship in care of South Dakota State University Foundation at address 815 Metairie Avenue in Brookings. Continuing obituaries from Cocoa Beach, Florida, formerly Sioux City, Russell Robert Snyder. Russell Snyder passed away at the age of 68 on Tuesday, October 12th. Services 2 p.m. on Friday at Daniel's Family Wyoming Chapel in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Next from Sioux City, Marilyn J. Reed. Marilyn Reed, age 88, passed away October 9th at Whispering Creek Senior Living in Sioux City. Services scheduled for 10 a.m. on Wednesday at Christy Smith Funeral Home, Larkin Chapel on Outer Belt Drive. Visitation scheduled for 1 hour prior. Burial in Memorial Park Cemetery with online condolences are welcomely expressed at the Christy Smith website. And donations for Ms. Reed may be left to the Alzheimer's Association or to cancer research. From Sioux City and concluding obituaries for this morning, Robert Thomas Reynolds Sr. Mr. Reynolds was 73, passed away on Tuesday, October the 12th. Family and friends invited to attend Celebration of Life gathering from 2 to 4 Saturday at Dakota Dunes Country Club. Robert, and that's all the information I can provide. You may visit the website for, I don't even know who's handling the arrangements.
Well, our condolences to all those who have lost loved ones, and that concludes the reading of the obituaries today. All right, I'd like to share with you a story from the living section, page D10. This is a story about the Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps considers nature-based flood control, and this is from the Associated Press. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is known for damming rivers and building levees to keep waterways at bay, but a new initiative seeks natural flood control solutions as climate change brings increasingly frequent and severe weather events that test the limits of concrete and steel. It only makes sense to use Mother Nature's flood defenses as one of the tools to combat destruction from intense rains in the middle of the country and storms and sea level rise on the coasts, says Todd Bridges, who heads the Corps Engineering with Nature Initiative. Pieces are in place to make the change. In the 2020 Water Resources Development Act, Congress directed the Corps to consider nature-based systems on equal footing with more traditional infrastructure. And the initiative was directly funded for the first time last year with $12.5 million. But the Corps is often constrained by its own rules and the way costs and benefits of its projects are evaluated. The Corps has a lot of people who are used to doing things a certain way, said Jimmy Haig, the Nature Conservancy's senior water policy advisor. We're tracking some projects right now where nature-based solutions are almost an afterthought. In Missouri, the Corps recently completed a levee setback along the Missouri River after the existing levee was overtopped and breached by flooding in 2019. Rather than simply repairing the levee, the Corps built a five-mile stretch farther from the river, opening up about 1,000 acres of floodplain to help reduce future flooding while providing habitat for rare and declining species. Dave Crane, the Corps' environmental lead on the project, said making it happen was not simple. The Corps is required to repair levees at the lowest cost, and only extreme damage to the original levee made building a new one possible under its rules. The Corps also likes to work fast to repair levees before a new flood, and moving the levee required time for planning and acquiring land. The local levee district needed to buy millions of dollars in farmland that would no longer be protected. With help from the Nature Conservancy and local community buy-in, the Corps constructed the setback, but it's far from the norm. Bridges hopes a new 1,000-page international guidelines for nature-based systems, 5 years in the making, will push the Corps to take nature-based solutions more seriously. The manual was developed in collaboration with the Netherlands and the United Kingdom, among others. The stakes are rising. Over the past 5 years alone, weather and climate-related disasters cost the U.S. more than $630 billion in damages. Richard Spinrad, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said when the guidelines were released on September 16th. He said, "How we evaluate benefits of nature-based solutions is the key issue." So that is a quote from Mr. Bridges. "Putting monetary value on their flood protection is a first step. Bridges also wants the Corps to recognize social and environmental benefits not traditionally considered. For example," he said, "a mangrove forest can provide wildlife habitat, enjoyment for people who dive, fish, or boat, as well as cleaner air and water. And while concrete flood walls fall apart and must be replaced, mangroves can grow, affording more protection over time. Florida has 500,000 acres of mangrove forest today that provide billions of dollars in flood risk reduction. How do we sustain or even grow that benefit in the future?" Bridges asked. "The Corps has rules beyond benefit assessments that complicate its adoption of such solutions. In Port Fourchon, Louisiana, authorities want to use dredging spoils to restore nearby marshland, but the Corps wants to pump the soils into the Gulf of Mexico," said Chet Chiasson, the port's executive director. "That's because the project's money comes from the Corps' navigation fund, requiring the agency to dispose of spoils as cheaply as possible. It doesn't matter that there is a separate ecosystem restoration fund for projects like the marsh," Chiasson said. "Their money is siloed, and they can't put funds together in a way that makes common sense," he said. In Northern California, near the state capital Sacramento, the Corps built the Yolo Bypass nearly a century ago to divert floodwaters. Its 59,000 acres have also become habitat for native and endangered species, including Chinook salmon and steelhead. Rick Johnson, executive director of the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency, wants to make needed improvements to the bypass while enhancing fish habitat. "But the Corps, which has a flood control easement on the property, has rules that require it to own property outright before doing ecosystem restoration work. We're in a position right now where it's hard to build new infrastructure, so we need to get what we can out of what's existing," Johnson said, "and we need to look at it through a multipurpose lens. Relatively little has been done to quantify benefits of nature-based flood control, but a 2016 study estimated coastal wetlands saved northeastern states from more than $625 million in damages during Superstorm Sandy. Census tracts with wetlands averaged 10% less property damage than those without," reported researchers from the University of California in Santa Cruz, the Nature Conservancy, and the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Thank you, Terry. That's been a long-term project since 2019's flood up and down I-29, as we around here can recall. But south of here, on our way to Kansas City several times, we've seen that work in Missouri, and on our way to southern Iowa, we've seen that work in Iowa. So I hope the wisdom prevails and that they go about rebuilding that area down there in a slightly different way, setting aside acres that we just can't continue to farm when we flood as much as we farm. It just doesn't pay. Next, I'll move to the sports page. And theoretically, Morningside versus Briarcliff in football should be a pretty intense rivalry. But BCU can close, not until BCU can close a large gap that divides the programs, should it be considered an annual rite of passage for Morningside to ride the saddle. Some years ago, shortly after Briarcliff added football to its intercollegiate sports schedule, it was decided that the annual game between Briarcliff and Morningside, located in the same city, be dubbed the Battle for the Saddle. Well, therefore, the winner each season gets to keep the saddle, and its players and coaches celebrate by taking post-game rides in that saddle. Saturday, the first person to be lifted in the air aboard that saddle was Coach Steve Ryan from Morningside. That constituted a milestone of sorts for him. Until then, Ryan had not taken a turn on the saddle. He had big reasons. In an absolutely gorgeous afternoon yesterday at Memorial Field when the two teams locked horns, Ryan joined an elite list with a 200th coaching victory while Morningside coach. Morningside defeated the Chargers 84-7. Morningside ran its record against Briarcliff to 19 games, no defeats since they started playing football 20 years ago. And now in his 20th season, Ryan is the fourth fastest, including all divisions of college football, the fourth fastest coach to that 200 victory plateau. Ryan is quoted as saying, "I'm just proud of our guys today. This is a great school, and I'm kind of excited for all the guys who've played here. Haven't really thought about in terms of my regard, but just looking around here and seeing some former players is pretty special to us." Ryan was asked which games he remembers the most up to this point. And he says, "Well, one of the big ones was beating Wayne State in the very first football game I coached. Beating Sioux Falls to win our first conference championship was a big memory for me. And obviously, the national championships were big memories for me, too. As for a maiden voyage in the saddle," he said, "well, this is the first time on the saddle. I said I would do it if it was my 200th win, and it just happened to fall that way. Turned out to be a day of milestones for the Morningside University team, and individual players had some of their best days." Another college score just up the road: Northwestern College played over in Jamestown, North Dakota this weekend, but Northwestern just equally crushed Jamestown 63-7. So we're setting up here for the last game of the regular season with Northwestern and Morningside hitting against each other. It should be quite a game. If everybody stays healthy, it should be quite a football game.
I think that's scheduled for November 5th or November 6th. It is Saturday, November 6th.
That's correct.
It'll be exciting.
Yes, it will.
Well, let's see. We're moving toward the end of our broadcast, and so I would like to conclude by sharing with you, Alan, would you help me? I'd like to share the birthdays today.
Next, we'll turn to birthdays for the day, and Terry will start us out here with a birthday on this day.
Yes, today is the birthday of Shinichi Suzuki, and so he is known for developing the Suzuki violin method. That is a way of teaching very young children to play classical music by listening and imitating the way they learn to speak. And it is also not a birthday, but an important date. On this day in 1604, Johannes Kepler witnessed the last supernova observed in the Milky Way. And he had been an astronomer before the age of telescopes, and spent his life studying the universe with the naked eye. So let's move to a couple.
a birthday. Today was an actress named Jean Arthur. Next, Jerry Siegel, a writer and an illustrator, born 1914. Arthur Miller. And Terry?
Oh, Arthur Miller is the author of Death of a Salesman, and he's also the author of The Crucible. All right, a couple more birthdays we have there, Alan.
Actress Rita Hayworth and actress Beverly Garland, and a motorcyclist that some may recall, Evel Knievel, a stunt performer.
Yeah, he lived from 1938 and he passed away in 2007. Well, that is all the time we have this morning for our broadcast of the Sioux City Journal on October the 17th of 2021, reading for the Iowa Reading Information Service. This is Terry McGaffin.
And Alan McGaffin.
And thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.